you for joining us this morning, those who are on Zoom, and it's nice to see a hall that is filling up again with members, live bodies, live people, able to see most of our faces, smiles. It's wonderful. So today is a kind of a celebratory day. Most of what I'll be talking about this morning, then we'll have a little ceremony afterwards, relates to the birth of the Buddha, our ancestor, spiritually sort of our Adam and Eve, all in one, that we are descended from. But I first want to talk about another birthday celebration, another birth that I certainly want to acknowledge to our community, which is we have finally given birth to Great Cloud Refuge. And it has been a difficult pregnancy. For women who've had difficult pregnancies or men who've been around, we know what that is. So this is, but usually the difficult pregnancy is only 9 months. This has been 5 years of, this is probably the longest pregnancy, difficult pregnancy in history. It's kind of been interesting. I think a week ago we celebrated, we thought we were at the end and we had had our final inspection and we passed it and we thought, oh, this is it. And then we read the fine print that even though we had had our final inspection, there were still some kind of bureaucratic things, forms and things that had to be crossed off. And I mean, you know, it's we for those of you who remember Franz Kafka, it has been like that for the last 5 years. But anyhow, this past week, I think it was Wednesday, Thursday we got our official certificate of occupancy. So we are legal. And the print wasn't even dry when we went into action. For those of you who've been around the center, you might have, if you ever wandered into the community room or wandered into other rooms in the education building or downstairs here in the, we have been accumulating things for Great Cloud for years now, always anticipating its opening. So anyhow, half our community, half our buildings have been storage. But beginning Thursday, we went right into action. It was really wonderful to see people here. And it's quite amazing. I want to bow in gratitude to the people who have been helping the last few days. I mean, just to give you a sense, I mean, all of a sudden beds are being set up because the beds were all in, you know, the single beds and the double beds, they all were in, you know, parts. So they all had to be put together. And then the mattresses were all these kind of in these little boxes and you open them up and they expand and what? I mean, everything, right? Towel racks and towels and shower curtains and towel racks. And I mean, it's just been, you know, stocking everything and toilet paper. And, you know, all of a sudden we're, tables, right? The little nightstands. And anyhow, it's been quite something. And it was quite wonderful yesterday. I mean, we've had people helping this week, but yesterday we had a good bunch of people and it was really just quite incredible to see it all come alive. And for me, the wonderful thing is we moved this wonderful wooden sculpture of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Compassion, into the main hallway. And we started putting up some of the Buddhist art around to sort of give it a sense of home. So we have finally given birth to Great Cloud Refuge, and it's my hope that all of us, all of you here, will be able over these coming years to enjoy really this wonderful part of our practice, which is going on retreat. You know, traditionally, meditators, practitioners have always gone on retreat for realization. But I think in our day, when our minds are so preoccupied with things and responsibilities and activities and all this, you know, constantly that it's often sort of difficult to incorporate some of the basic teachings and principles of Buddhism without really time to really work on them, reflect on them deeply, uninterruptedly. And so we really hope to use Great Cloud Refuge, you know, not just for meditative retreats, but really for all kinds of retreats to help people incorporate the teachings and really, and also just give people an opportunity to step back from life, you know, whatever life is. I mean, obviously this is life, but when I say life, I mean, you know, your the ordinary life, the busy life, the life of activity, you know, to step back and really nourish themselves is what is most important. So, and the other birth, of course, is we are having our first retreat beginning Saturday. It's going to be a week-long retreat, a wisdom retreat. we have 30 people, which is below our capacity, but we began out, you know, registrations when, you know, there were different protocols from the CDC, so we wanted to limit it. But also because it's our first retreat and with the food and anyhow, we thought we'd give ourselves a break, and you know, 30 people seem manageable. So that begins next Saturday, and I'm sure there'll be more about it. But I do have an announcement. Brian, who is overseeing the kitchen, is trying his best to totally sanitize and get everything in the kitchen in shape. I think he started yesterday, and I know he was here yesterday afternoon. So anyhow, if there are two people could meet Brian at 2:30, either people in the hall. If people in the hall, anybody in the hall can do it at 2:30, please see Angie. And if anybody in the Zoom world, the online world, just chat it into Raylin, right? And just say that you could do it at 2:30 and Brian will get back to you. And we'll probably be needing the help of the community later this week after all the final things. And there's still things being painted, you know, that kind of stuff. So we'll probably need help in final kind of putting everything together and cleaning toward the end of the week. So there'll probably be some announcement going out about that probably next couple of days. So please, if you can, probably it'll be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, there'll be some needs for the community. So that's one birthday. Sort of we're of the younger generation. But today we're here to celebrate the birth of Shakyamuni Buddha. And this painting, Tanka, relates to that. He is our ancestor. We would not be here without him. So that makes him kind of special to us. And historically, his birth is celebrated in the fourth month, the fourth lunar month, which changes every year. This year, it's on Wednesday, the 26th, full moon day. But since we meet on Sundays, we are celebrating it today. So before I talk specifically about the Buddha and his birth, Shakyamuni Siddhartha, Siddhartha, you know, was the name given to him at his birth, and it means something like the one who achieves their aim, Siddhartha, the one who achieves their purpose, their aim in this life. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But in sort of, excuse me, in kind of traditional Buddhist teachings, there is, you know, Buddhist cosmology in the traditional coming from the Asian countries where it came from, the cosmology is very different than ours. Our cosmology tends to be linear. We're going from here to there. Traditional Asian cosmology is circular. It just keeps going round and round, endless world cycles that are born and then basically end, and new world cycles begin. Just like birth and death, everything is birth and death. World cycles are birth and death. Planets are birth and death. So it is said that Buddhas don't always appear. in world cycles. There are many world cycles, many worlds where Buddhas don't appear. Now, when I say Buddhas, I mean awakened beings who show the rest of us, kind of reveal to us the true purpose and meaning of life, and but even more importantly, reveal to us why we suffer, why human beings suffer, why human beings have unhappiness, why people struggle, why people have difficulties, why people harm each other. I mean, all the sort of issues that we take as kind of normal parts of human life, a Buddha appears and shows us there's a reason why things don't work, and there is a solution. And so the Buddha comes in and not only points out that out to us, but most importantly, shows the beings in that world a very practical path that they can follow to create, both personally and societally, the world that they want. And he shows them the reasons why it's not occurring. So again, to be born, so it said, to be born at a time like we have, to be born into a world where a Buddha has appeared. So that's number one, a Buddha has appeared in this world, appeared over 2,600 years ago. Secondly, teachings die out. So we are fortunate that 2,600 years later, the fundamental teachings and practices that began with Siddhartha, Shakyamuni Buddha, 2,600 years ago, have been maintained and passed on generation to generation, so they are still here in our world cycle right now, still available to us right now. And not only is the Buddha's teachings continue to this day, it's not just intellectual. It's not just in the books. It's not just in people who've gone to college to study it. It's alive in people who have practiced deeply the Buddha Dharma and have come to realization of the truths of Buddha Dharma. So it's still alive in this world. And in truth, Buddhas are still alive in this world. There are Buddhas in our own world who appear historical right now, who have shown and continue to show us another way, right? So all of this, if those of us say, wow, yeah, this is something special. You know, there are many places in this world where the teachings aren't available. There's nobody teaching this. There's nobody showing beings this. There are places in this world where the conditions of life make it almost unable for people to hear the Dharma and to practice the Dharma. So we are more than fortunate, all of us, that not only do we have this opportunity to encounter these teachings that can liberate us and all beings from their suffering, but also that we have the opportunities to practice, that we have practice centers and we have teachers and we have friends and all this. So you put it all together, we are very fortunate. We have good fortune. So what is important about the birth of the Buddha and in Asian countries or in Buddhist temples here in this country? The birth of the Buddha is celebrated. People, you know, it's sort of like Christmas or Easter, you know, or other religious holidays in other faith traditions. It's a special day, and people, you know, celebrate in their homes, they celebrate in the temples, they do their best to practice diligently on this special day, often making offerings. You know, we make offerings. Offerings are generosity. You know, Usually we only make offerings to ourselves. We offer ourselves food. We offer ourselves clean water. We offer ourselves gifts. But to offer it to something, to someone else, to something that has great meaning and purpose and that we're grateful for, like giving a gift, is really what offerings are about. So again, it is celebrated in the Buddhist world. So let us... So we can, you know, it's sort of like the story of the birth of the Buddha is a little bit, I think, like the story of Jesus, which is the one I'm most familiar with. You know, there are some people who see Jesus as a man, right? As a great man, became a great master within his tradition. And there are some people who see them as much more than that, the Son of God. Right, so it's sort of like a multi-dimensional, right? He's either on one hand, he's seen as a human being, on one hand, he's seen as the Son of God, eternal, right? And sort of Buddhism has that same thing. There are some who see the Buddha as kind of according to his historical story. And I think everybody agrees on his historical story. All Buddhists agree. But many Buddhists, you know, they have this bigger picture, which is because it takes many, many, many lifetimes to develop all the qualities of mind that a Buddha manifests. Even though it is quite possible for all of us to become enlightened, have an enlightenment experience, and to lead an awakened life in this life. But the actual ability of a human being to actually have no negativity at all, mind totally purified, empty, only wholesome qualities of mind. According to Buddhism, this takes many, many, many lifetimes. Sort of a process of purification. So it is sort of said that sort of this energetic force of what became Siddhartha had gone through many, 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 many lifetimes. All, you know, not just as a human being, as an animal, I mean, always demonstrating a great capacity to live a selfless life, to put others' interests ahead of his own, and to practice deeply the meditative practice. So now he's up there in Tushita Heaven, where they kind of, they hang out just prior to taking their final incarnation as a Buddha. So he's now ready for the big assignment, you see. Up to now, he's been doing all these good deeds in so many different realms, but now he's ready to appear in this human world, this earth world of ours, as our Buddha. And so he's ready, and because he's very conscious and aware, he can choose where he'll be born, and he chooses to be born to manifest in what's now southern Nepal, in Kapilavastu. And anybody ever goes to India on Buddhist pilgrimage in Nepal, you can go to Kapilavastu and see the ruins of stupas and temples that once were the whole Buddhist establishment. So he manifests in the kind of leading family of this little kingdom. I mean, sometimes people think, oh, he was born a great king. I mean, little king. Feudal times, lots of kingdoms. So he was born to a royal family, and it's interesting. According to the tradition, mythological tradition, the birth was miraculous. Queen Maya, his mother, Maya Devi, had a dream. And in the dream, there was this beautiful white elephant, which symbolizes all kinds of things. And this elephant touched her with its tusk. And immediately she felt so happy and peaceful in her dream. And in those days, you know, they had soothsayers, seers attached to the royal family. And so she asked their local one what the meaning was. And he says, a great being is going to be born to you, i.e. you're pregnant. So she goes through 10 months of pregnancy, they say, which I think was normal. They considered normal, or they counted differently. And it was very traditional in that, you know, Vedic culture, that when a woman was about to give birth, she returned to her maternal home, I guess to her mothers and sisters and aunts and uncle, you know, aunts and everything, and they would birth her baby. So she's on the way from where she's living with King Suddhodana in Kapilavastu to her ancestral home. And on the way, they stop in a little park, and she must be feeling something going on inside her. And she sort of steadies herself by grabbing onto this tree. I don't know, can you all see this? And I don't know how close you can see, but this painting, this tanka is of that moment. So she is, she's reaching up and she's touching the tree. And at that moment, she gave birth to what we became known as the Buddha. Of course, in the traditional way, it is said that when he emerged fully formed, not like a little infant, not like a little newborn. He was fully formed, and not only that, he could walk, and he could speak. And so supposedly at that time, he took 7 steps, and at each of those steps, a lotus bloomed right where he touched. And he said something quite extraordinary. He said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I am the only one. Now that in English sounds kind of egotistical. So it loses a lot in translation. He's really announcing that he is the one of which we all are part of. He is not the one as an individual, but he is the one of which the many manifest. So they returned to the palace. His astrological chart is done, as was done in those days. And the astrologer said he's got a very wonderful chart. He will attain great things. If he is a ruler, he will be a great ruler of this kingdom. But I also see in his chart that he also has the potential to be a great renunciate, a great spiritual, he will be a great spiritual teacher. So it's sort of like he will be royalty, but there are 2 different paths to him. So the story is, of course, that his father, as a typical father who wanted his child to take over the family business, so to speak, did not want his son renouncing the kingdom, renouncing the world, and becoming a renunciate. That did not appeal to him. So he raised, like many parents, he raised his child, trying to protect them from the seamier side of life, so to speak, from the messier side of life, so to speak, and tried to keep him safe and pleasant. Tried to make sure that he had lots of pleasure in his life. and that really all suffering, all difficulty was not part of his life. So he kind of grew up with great ease and a great accomplishment as a child, as a teenager. But there's a very interesting experience he has, and I think we can all relate to this. And I think it's very important because he remembers this experience. When later on he became an ascetic, and after years of asceticism and really self-denial. So he has this experience when he's a teenager. So there is the annual festival. You know, they're agricultural people. So before they, when they plant all the seeds of the year, they have a festival, and it was very hot. And the Buddha's there, well, Siddhartha is a young man, he's here observing this festival, and it's very hot. And so he goes and he sits, goes off by himself, and he sits under a tree and he observes the goings on. So it's very hot. And what does he observe? He observes the men who are driving the oxen or the cattle that are pulling the plows, that are turning over the earth. He sees them and he sees everybody's hot and he sees how the oxen are struggling and he sees how the oxen, the drivers are sort of beating the oxen to get them to work hard in this hard work. And he sees the plow cutting the earth, and as the plow is cutting the earth, he sees that it's cutting, worms and insects and little rodents are running. And he reflects deeply on this. You see, he sees, and it's hot, and everybody's hot, and they're doing something meaningful, and yet he sees it's creating so much suffering. I mean, everybody is kind of suffering. Suffering in the heat and the animals and the oxen and the drivers who are having to drive them. He sees another side of it. And he sort of, whatever that experience does to him, he sort of reflects deeply, deep inside himself, and somehow reaches a place deeper than that drama. He finds a place within himself that is incredibly peaceful and calm, kind of spacious. And he sort of has his own kind of experience that he's never had of something other than the ups and downs and comings in life. And I think that's very important. I mean, it's very important for him because years later, when he was in the depths of his asceticism, thinking that was a spiritual path, he remembered this. He remembered this incident. And he realized what he experienced in this moment was closer to where he wants to get to than all his 6 years of ascetic practice. It's like, he knew that it was already here. It was within him. And all his driving himself was only getting himself further away. But I think that experience is very important for all of us, because we all know, we've all experienced that place of non-suffering within ourselves. We've all experienced momentarily, time in our life, when we have felt good, at ease, happy, right? In all kinds of ways. Many people, it's in nature or music or, I've heard women talk about giving birth sort of as a transcendent experience, even in the midst of pain. So we all know it, We all know it. And that's very important, Because if we lose all memory of that, if we lose all contact with that part within ourselves, that brief moment or time, some people, they report they have drug experiences which let them touch this place, right? But it shows us this is within me. I have this capacity. It's already here. You know, and I can taste it. I've tasted it. Even for a brief moment, calm, open, spacious, selfless. Nothing going on. No reference point. I mean, we obviously, some of us have memories of childhood. Sort of, if we can remember that far back. Before it all began. And often before really self developed very strongly. Things were peaceful, things were calmer, things were more enjoyable, things were fun, things were light, right? Hopefully we all have those moments somewhere. They're there. I mean, we often tell a narrative, some people, of just difficulty, but even in that, there were moments of relief. We all try to find those places of relief, you see. And that's what Siddhartha did that day. He, under the tree, by himself, just moved by, you know, what was going on around him and sort of knowing he just couldn't, it was touching him deeply. He discovered that place within himself. So it's not like, and then he went off and became, you know, it didn't happen like that. Like many of us, kind of got up, or his mother or father called out to him, come on, come join the, come join the ceremonies or the festivities. And he just was off, forgot the whole thing, returned to his normal life. But then, you know, and I'm sure many are familiar with the Buddha's life, but it's worth always reminding ourselves because we forget. Because in a certain way, many of us, some of us have, many good conditions in our life. Many of us have difficult conditions in our life. Many of us have the difficulties of life in our face, and many of us aren't looking at them. We forget about them. And even if we have looked at them, we forget about them as soon as they're over. As I said, the Buddha had a life of ease. His parents had done his best to eliminate all obstacles, challenges to him, and really all maturity. I mean, he was very accomplished in his little world, but he was not emotionally mature because he only knew one side of life, you see. That was the side of life of, you know, everything's good. And if it's not good, you just, you know, have a party and everything will be better. Do something pleasurable. So he always had something to look forward to. But as we know, according to the history, things, he had experiences that broke through that bubble of pleasure seeking. And that is, he encountered for the first time in his life, supposedly, he saw sickness, he saw sick people. And if anybody's ever been sick or anybody's ever been around anybody who's sick, it's not a pretty sight. We are not at our best and other people aren't at their best. We I mean, we see people and go, are you well? You know, you're gonna look at them, you go, something's not right. Right? Because when we're sick, we lose kind of our life energy, and you can see it, and you can feel it. You don't feel good, you're sick. So we saw a sick person, he saw an aging person. There are aging people in this hall, so young people, take a good look at them. One day we're all gonna look like them. I mean, look at me talking that way. One day you're all gonna look like me or something, or Sam in the background or something, other people, you know. you know, he saw aging. It kind of, you know, again, from the side of youth, it's not a pretty sight, right? The body doesn't look as radiant and as youthful as when it was young. It doesn't have the energy. It doesn't have the stamina. It just, you know, aches and pains. So he saw aging, and then he saw death. You know, and in those times, you saw death. If you went out in the town, if you left the palace, if you went into, you know, if you went on the street, so to speak, you would see death, because they would carry the bodies through the street, and they'd take them to the ghats, where they'd be burnt. And it was kind of public. So you'd see dead bodies going through the street, you'd see them be taken to the burning ghats, you'd see them. So I think there have been a lot of pictures of that from India recently, because of what's going on there. So you see, that's extreme, because there's so many going on, but that's what happens. They're burnt publicly. So you see the dead bodies, and you see them being cut up, and you see them being pushed back in, and you get the smell. So, and again, not a very pleasant experience. So, you know, he was quite, you know, these were like brief encounters, but, again, he has that introspective quality, which his parents did their best not to nurture. And some of us may have found that when we began to try to nurture our introspective qualities, some, maybe our family was not very happy with us. They wanted us to be nurturing worldly reflections and worldly qualities. But he reflected deeply, and it sort of brought into question sort of everything he had. Because of course he thought, you know, it would just go on forever and ever, just like us, right? We think it's gonna go on forever and ever. We think we're gonna stay young, we think we're gonna stay healthy, we think everybody we know is gonna stay young and healthy, everybody's gonna continue to look the same, people aren't gonna get sick, people aren't gonna get diseased, I'm not gonna get sick, you're not gonna get sick, we're all gonna live happily ever after, right? That's the dream, because that's what it looks like, unless we reflect. Right? Unless we reflect deeply and see that this unfolding of sickness, old age, death is the normal condition for all beings. Everyone goes through this process. The rapidity of it, the speed of it, the timing of it, you know, the uniqueness of it is different for everybody. But every human being, like everything else, as I said in the beginning, even world systems, even planets go through this. Same process. This is the process, the unfolding. When he kind of realized that, it sort of brought his whole life into like a sham. You know what I'm saying? Because he was putting so much energy as if this was just going to go on forever. You know, and when he realizes, when he saw this other side and then finds out this is not unique, but this happened to everyone's happened, everybody in your life, everybody you love, you know, profound kind of personal crisis, one might call it in modern parlance. Fortunately, he didn't go to a therapist to kind of help him cope better with it, because he saw the fourth encounter, he saw a mendicant or something, a hermit, somebody who would renounce the world. And this person, you know, was out in the street, had no possessions, and looked happy, looked peaceful. And he was kind of struck by that, you know, because most of us think, oh, I need all my stuff, you see. I need all my stuff to be happy, or I need this, or I need that, then I'll be happy. And here he saw somebody who basically had nothing, and they were happy, peaceful. And that kind of really, again, shook him up. So he goes through this crisis, and he's very struck by that renunciate, and he decides that that's what he's going to do. I mean, he cannot enjoy his palace life. And he was married at that point, had a child. He couldn't enjoy it anymore the way he used to, because he saw this bigger picture of the unfolding, you see. And it was very painful to him. So, since he was the heir apparent, he went to his father, and he told his father what he was thinking, that he really wanted to renounce his position as heir to the throne and wanted to go off and be a mendicant. Obviously, his father was not happy. And his father said to him, as probably many fathers would do, "What can I do to keep you here?" Right? And Siddhartha said, "Well, all you got to do is give me four assurances. And if you can give me these four assurances, Daddy," he didn't call him Daddy, I will stay and I will be your heir." And then, now that he knew that he could negotiate something with his son, he was quite happy. And he said, "Okay, yeah, tell me what they are and I'll give them to you." And so Siddhartha said, "The first assurance I want from you is that I will always stay young, just like I am now. The second assurance I want from you is that I will never get sick, I will never have disease. Third, I will not age. Fourth, I will not die. You can give me all these assurances." And I think actually there was a fifth one, which is I can keep all my possessions too. He said, "If you can assure me that if I stay here in the palace, you can give me all those things, I'm very happy to stay." Obviously what? He couldn't give them to him, because he knew the truth too. We all know the truth. But very few of us stop and acknowledge the truth of impermanence. As the Buddha said, of all my teachings, the teachings of impermanence is the largest one. He said it is like the elephant in the jungle. The elephant is the largest animal in the jungle, and the footprint of the elephant is the largest footprint of any animal in the jungle. He said, "My teachings later on, my teachings are impermanence, are the biggest footprint that I'm leaving, because everything else flows from that, right? I mean, we wouldn't be here, right? If Shakyamuni, who became Shakyamuni, Siddhartha, hadn't stopped and had those experiences, and rather than just looking and going, "Wow, that's terrible. Ooh. I'm going back to the palace and have a drink. It's a rough day seeing this stuff. What a downer, seeing sick people, dead people, smelling flesh burning." But he didn't do that, because he reflected deeply and saw the universality of it. So he did what we don't do. But fortunately, because we have his teachings, we have his reflections, we're able to learn. We can use his awakening, his questioning, his reflection to wake us up. So everything flows from that, right? So everything we could say, And of course, he took a very radical, we won't go into it today, he took a very radical. He had a good life. He decided, just knowing the bigger picture and just being so moved by wanting to find the way. There had to be a way that one can transcend this world of impermanence, this world of suffering. There had to be a way. And it was because of that that energy. That's what led him to, leave his home, leave his family, leave comfort and stability, leave the known, and to set out into the unknown. He didn't know what awaited him. And everything came from there. I mean, it's from this experiences that led him to his spiritual searching, that led him to his great enlightenment, that led him to his, teaching for 49 years, having disciples, having students, who then have passed on this Dharma now for 2,600 years. And so again, I think this is very meaningful to us. I mean, we may not all, it may not be as dramatic. You know, our spiritual journey may not be as dramatic as Siddhartha's, but who knows? We're not done yet. The Buddha of this new age could be sitting here or on Zoom today. We don't know, or somewhere in the world. But in a certain way, his story is has. You know, like myth tells deeper stories. And we are all participating in that myth. Everybody who's on this call, all of us, to one degree or another, things have happened in our life. Situations have happened in our life, within our personal life, observations, reflections, that have caused us to think, reflect, and look more deeply into meaning and purpose, causes of happiness, causes of suffering, right? And it is so all of us have done what he did. And that has caused us to be here. Wherever we are here because we are looking for something other than what, the normative culture is providing us, right? And again, most of us are not as extremely as Siddhartha was. But again, being a mendicant, being a hermit, being a wanderer was something that was not unknown in his culture. They were around, it was available, but. So again, we are all, we are all participating in this bigger journey. And we all have within us a baby Buddha. We all have within us an awakened nature. The birth of a Buddha in this world, while it's extraordinary for us, we all have a baby Buddha that we need to give birth to, that is within us, that we are, it's in gestation. And if you're a good gestator, I don't know if that's a word, if you're a good gestator, you want to take care of what's inside you. You want to give it the best conditions, the best nourishment, the best nutriments, so it can grow. So when it manifests, when it comes out into the world, as embryos come out into the world eventually, we want them to have the best possible advantages, right? And how they manifest. So in a certain way, this is what also today means. It is in terms of our world, we have a lot to be grateful for the birth of Siddhartha 2,600 years ago in southern Nepal. But we're also reminded of, that each of us have the opportunity, both individually and collectively, when we are creating a sangha, when we create a home for a sangha, when we create places for sangha to practice, we are creating conditions to birth. You know, it's another way we can look at our community and our center and our facilities. This is a birthing center. Maybe we should rename it. But this is a birthing center. We are giving birth within each of us to something quite new and fresh, which will hopefully give great benefit to us and great benefit to our world. So let me just stop here. Any questions? I mean, any questions anybody has about anything I've said this morning, both in the hall and also on Zoom? So if you're on Zoom, you can chat your question into Raylin. If you're in the hall, do we have a? Did we think about this? Jacqueline. So if anybody has any question about anything that was said today? Yeah, I don't think anything I said was very controversial. Oh, I spoke too quickly. Yes, Jose. I'm only joking. Yeah, he did leave the palace. I mean, abandoning is a little strong word. We'll talk about that. Go on. So let me just say just wait. So Jose's, he's not the first person to say this. So he's saying, hold on a second. It looks like Siddhartha abandoned his family, right? Go on.
Mm-hmm. Did the son of Siddhartha came back and was one of his disciples, or?
Yeah, so the question is, so then what happened, right? So Jose said he's been thinking about this, leaving, what happened to the family? So it's interesting. What happened to his mother first? What happened to his mother, Maya? What happened to Mother Maya? She died 8 days after his birth. According to the story, why do the, and supposedly all mothers of Buddhas die 8 days after. Why do they die? Because if a mother sees her child leaving home, it would break her heart. So therefore, to save her from that, she dies. Actually, you know where she went? She went to Tushita Heaven. And you know what? Being a good son, you know what Shakyamuni did during the course? You know, these are tankas. There's a series called The Eight Major Lives of the Buddha. And one of them, if you ever see, if you go online or if you see, is you'll see the Buddha going up a staircase. And what that is, he's going up at some point in his life. He went up to Tushita Heaven, taught his mother the Dharma, and liberated her. So he was a good son, didn't forget his mother. Like you said, he, according to the story, you know, again, you know, these weren't nuclear families, okay? I mean, this wasn't like, you know, he was living with his wife and child, you know, in a little suburban house. Right, they lived in a, you know, big extended family. You know, it's a very different world. So, you know, they're all very tied in. Okay, and obviously, you know, she was well taken care of by family. But then if we won't go into today, but in the story of the Buddha, historically, he did come back at some point to Kapilavastu, where he was raised, after he was, you know, had become the Buddha. But early on in his ministry, so to speak, and actually taught Buddhism to his family. His son Rahula became a disciple of him. And so after Maya Devi, his mother had died, was very traditional was the father, King Suddhodana, married her sister, which I guess was very common in those days. So he married her sister, whose name was, I think, Prajapati. And Prajapati became the first nun. So his son became a monk, Rahula, and his stepmother, I guess you call her, which is really his aunt, became the first nun. So does that put your mind at ease? Yeah, there is a culture. Yeah, there is a cultural context. But it's very interesting, you know, having lived somewhat in Asia. I mean, obviously, from one side, families, traditions, property, you know, family name, you know, there is that energy. But in a lot of cultures, you know, devoting oneself to spirituality or spiritual quests is also deeply respected. So it's not as if, you know, this is like in our society, right, where this is very extreme. It's really not that extreme. I mean, I can only speak from like Tibetan culture, you know, where, you know, pretty much every family had a son who became a monk, you know, a daughter who became a nun. I mean, it was very common. And for them to go off and, you know, say, I'm going to go on a 3-year solitary retreat up in the mountains, or a 5-year or a 10-year, or, you know, I'm just going off, you know, was often deeply respected, you know, as a great pursuit in life, because they knew what this was about. You know, this was what they, you know, I mean, this is what sustained the culture, you know, were these people. So it was highly, highly respected. So it wasn't sort of as odd as it may appear, or extreme as it appears in our culture. Yeah, it was much more deeply respected, and you know, families could be happy even though they'd be sad. I mean, do you understand? It's because people are human, so it's really both. So let me just say, after we end this morning, for those of us here in the hall in Tampa, outside we have a little baby Buddha. And traditionally on the day of the Buddha's birthday, traditionally people bathe the Buddha. So that you'll see out there, there is a little statue of a baby Buddha. If he doesn't look like an infant, don't be surprised. Remember, he came out fully formed, and he's got one finger up and one finger down. Remember, above the heavens, below the heavens, I alone am the honored one. So that's sort of whenever you see that, that's the baby Buddha, who doesn't look like a baby Buddha. And we will bathe him. Often they bathe him either in pure water, they pour it over him, or they bathe him in sweet tea. They tea over him. And again, it's, you know, like everything else in Buddhism, it has multiple meanings, but in the same way, we bathe our minds, we purify our minds, right? Of all negativity. We you know, we might say that our practice is washing our minds, cleaning our minds. And so it's symbolic of that. When we pour water over the tea, and I believe so everyone will all file out, we will bathe the Buddha, and then there'll be a little birthday party. Is that right, Jacqueline? Diana, it'll be a little birthday party. We'll sing happy birthday to the Buddha. Yeah, so that'll be afterwards. And if any of you at home, if you want to have your own in your own way, you know, take a moment to just, you know, recollect, you know, the significance of the birth of a Buddha in this world, and where we'd be. Because, you know, even the people like, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, Dalai Lama, these other great teachers, you know, they're all manifestations of that stream. If it wasn't for Shakyamuni, I mean, if you could imagine that all wiped out, you know, like, again, I mean, I'm not inferring that there aren't other paths and other wonderful people in this world. I mean, I'm not, but I'm saying, because this path has such a special meaning to those of us, some of us, to imagine it not being here, and this endless production of masters, male and female, great practitioners for 2,600 years in every culture, society, time, just, you know, showing the path selflessly. It's quite extraordinary, especially in this, you know, monetized culture we live in, where everything is a price and everything is charged for. It's kind of wonderful to know that this teaching has been alive and offered freely for 2,600 years. So with that, I will, and just please remember, maybe Angie's gonna say it again, but please, if anybody can help Brian today, please chat it in at 2:30, or tell Angie afterwards and she'll relate that if you're in the hall. And please watch for some kind of email or something maybe coming out in a couple of days about, you know, the group of people who are getting Great Cloud together, any needs they'll have later in the week. Thank you, everyone.